Was there something that you were already aiming for? Was there a kind of music that you were attracted to already?
When I got into high school, I was sort of an overachiever little kid. Like, I had to be really good at everything. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make honor band, and I wanted to make Allstate. And so I started studying with a great guy named Robert Schmaltz, who was the trombone and musicology professor at what was USL at the time. It's UL Lafayette now. Mm-hmm. And I studied with him all through high school. And really started to get my trombone playing together, some with him. And if you asked me when I was 15 what I wanted to do, I would have told you I wanted to play trombone in the Chicago Symphony.
It was already like that. Okay.
Yeah, I had really gone to that space. Like, I wanted to be a classical musician. I wanted to go play trombone in the Chicago Symphony.
Did you listen to classical music?
Yeah.
That was what you knew.
I can't say it was real adventurous classical music listening. A Gershwin Cuban Overture was my favorite for a while. And it's funny, even then, it was sort of the jazzy side of these things. Like, when I was 10, we would go on these road trips. This is just when I started playing trombone. And my dad had these Chuck Mangione tapes, you know? And then he had all sorts of other, like, even cheesier stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always those things that I was drawn to. And later I realized, like, oh, it's these jazzier things were the things that I liked. Mm-hmm. Of all the Sinatra records my parents had, it was the one with the Basie band that I was like, no, that's the record. Mm-hmm. All this other stuff with the sappy strings and the ballads, yeah, whatever. But this record with the Basie band, this is great.
So did you think that was because you heard the brass going in it? Or you're going to go with the rhythmic thing? Or
I think a lot of it was the rhythmic thing. Because that stuff is really swinging.
Yeah. Interesting. What point did you decide you were going to get this serious enough that you went to college? Is that what happened? You decided to go to college to do it?
Yeah, I decided I was going to be a musician. Had gotten, you know, in the jazz band and started listening to some jazz in high school, but still.
What jazz did you listen to?
Oh, I think the gateway was kind of Spyro Gyra, Weather Report, Maynard Ferguson. Because, you know, when you're in a high school jazz band, you listen to Maynard.
I don't know. I wasn't there.
And that progressed into, like, on the big band side, Woody Herman, then Thad and Mel.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just randomly bought this Dizzy Gillespie Jazz at the Philharmonic record that was in the record store in the mall because I saw J.J. Johnson's name on it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, he's a trombone player. I think I've heard of that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home and put it on, and they did this Burning Sweet Georgia Brown. J.J. played 7 or 8 choruses, and it freaked me out. I was like, oh, my God, you can play a trombone like that? Really? That was like a really life-changing moment when I walked home and put that record on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think we all have one. How old were you then?
15 or 16.
Uh-huh. 15 or 16.
And then, yeah, so that spread out into Miles and like the kind of standard canon of mainstream 50s and 60s jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Which lasted through college. Although when I was still in high school, I remember going to Clint Majan's house one day.
Right, I remember that he lived out there.
Yeah, Clint and I went to high school together.
Okay.
And I walked in, he's like, dude, check this out. And he put on Coltrane Live in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the whole side one train doesn't even play.
Uh-huh.
And it's just Pharoah Sanders going.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just, you know, my jaw was hanging and I was looking at him like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
But I couldn't turn it off.
Right.
But I couldn't say, oh, that's great, I love it. But I was still like, well, no, let it play.
Right.
You know, and so that was like sort of the first little branch that started to go that way for me.
Uh-huh. And then how did this branch continue?
I came to Loyola.
How did you make that decision?
They gave me a bunch of money.
That was it. They were like, you're
excited. I thought maybe I was going to go to North Texas. And my trombone teacher at the time talked me out of it. He said, you know, you're at a very vulnerable point as a trombone player.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need to be studying with a grad student.
Mm-hmm.
And And I had also sent an application here to Loyola on one of those, like, you know, the jazz band came and played at my high school one year. And I thought, oh, that would be cool. Go live in New Orleans and, you know, study music. And lucky for me, there's a fabulous trombone teacher who was teaching at Loyola at the time, Dick Erb, who's taught, like, all these great trombone players in town. He's taught most of them.
What was his background?
Dick was a total, like, classical music snob. Played bass trombone with the New Orleans Symphony, then the Louisiana Philharmonic. Had studied with Arnold Jacobs in Chicago. And Jacobs is sort of the father of a whole school of classical brass playing. Or I should just say brass playing.
Where?
Chicago? In Chicago. Played. Irony. Jake played tuba with the Chicago Symphony forever. Okay. And so I studied with Dick and still came in, was going to be a classical trombone major, but I wanted to do all the jazz classes. And mm-hmm. So when we're doing our freshman advising signing up, the associate dean says to me, well, if you're going to take all these improv classes and stuff, you should just be a jazz major. Because if you're not, they won't count for anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll just like blow it up on all these electives. He said, but you get the same trombone lessons. You still play an orchestra. You do all the same stuff otherwise. So that's what I did.
So, had you been playing music outside of university or outside of school yet?
I got really lucky growing up in Lafayette because it was a big enough town that there was stuff happening, but a small enough town that there weren't that many people to do it. Mm-hmm. So, starting when I was 14, I played in the orchestra at church, and we would play, you know, in church services a couple times, once a month probably, but they would do this big Christmas show every year. And so, I would get to go sit in the pit. And they would hire these ringers to come in and play, but I'm sitting in the pit next to my trombone teacher and the best lead trumpet player in town, and I'm 14, and, you know, like, playing second trombone. But in a, like, I don't care if you're 14, here's your gig, go do it sort of situation. Okay. And so my junior and senior year in high school, I actually did some gigging, got paid a little, you know, did some, like, brass quartets in churches, and there was this old guy big band called the Skyliners that would do these big band dance club things once a month, and I played with them, you know. So yeah, I actually had like a little bit of interaction with professional musicians even when I was 17 and 16 17 18. Mm-hmm. Which was cool, which worked just fine to come into New Orleans, because the beautiful thing about New Orleans is you can go to school and play gigs,
right?
You know. And Loyola, at that time, was a very gig-oriented place.
What years was that?
I graduated high school in 88, so I was at Loyola, like, fall of 88 through spring of 92.
Okay.
And we played gigs. That's what you did. I mean, it wasn't art music. It was, like, totally a commerce-driven scene. Mm-hmm. But the calendar year that was my junior into senior year, I mean, like, I remember doing my taxes. I played 100 gigs that year. I was 20 years old.
Not bad. That's very rewarding.
Yeah, and they gave me money. I was like, how cool is this? I was totally hooked.
And at that point, what kind of gigs were you playing?
It was just about all either horn sections and cover bands or salsa bands. Very little jazz, very little creative music.
What salsa bands were you playing?
There's a guy named Pedro Cruz. Okay. Who had a band. We played Cafe Istanbul every Friday and Sunday night for a couple of years.
But that was a big scene.
That was a huge scene.
That's Pedro's. I remember it very well. I mean, it was like because of the Mas Mamones thing. I mean,
right, yeah. Oh, we would be at Istanbul, and Los Babies del Merengue would be across the street, and you couldn't drive your car down Frenchman.
All these Latin bands then. Yeah. So, okay, yeah, that's right. And so you were playing, you played with Pedro for a couple of years, and you were in sections in, in R&B bands?
Yeah, just like wedding band, cover bands, uh-huh. You know. I can play Brick House in all 12 keys. Actually, I'm kidding. Everybody plays it in one key. It would probably mess me up if I had to play it in another key.
So that was exciting. That must have been exciting, right?
Well, it was cool in that, like, I felt like a professional musician. And when I got out of school, I was actually paying my bills playing, you know, Brick House and Oyakomo Va, pretty
much. What's the feeling of being a professional musician?
Sleep late, practice, go to the gig, stay up late, sleep late, practice, go to the gig. You know, it was great.
Lifestyle you enjoy. Yeah,
because I had this goal, you know, like, when I was 15, if you asked me what I wanted to do, I would have said, I want to play with the Chicago Symphony. If I was 18, you asked me what I want to do, I said, I want to make a living playing trombone. Uh-huh. I would like to be able to pay my bills and not have to do anything else. And there, you know, and I reached a point where I was doing that. Uh-huh. Now, I wasn't making any art. Uh-huh. It was like totally a commercial thing.
Well, so you didn't mind that at all?
No, I thought it was great. And then after I'd done it for some number of years, it was like, maybe there's more to this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the artistic desires started to bubble back up.
What was it that you felt you needed more of, or where was it you needed, felt you needed to look at? What was amiss?
I think I felt I needed something that actually had to be me. All of the gigs that I was doing had to be a good trombone player, but they didn't have to be me.
Mm. You had some urge to express some part of you.
Yeah.
Same Jeff Albert. And in what ways were those gigs masking your personality?
Well, just because, I mean, like on the cover band, it's a thing. You know, you're trying to make it sound like the record. Mm-hmm. And your job is to be the trombone player in that section.
Mm-hmm. So, it was not a good question. I want to talk about something else that I know you're that in my mind differentiates you from a lot of players that I know, which is that you have very big involvement, or you have an ease with computers and with web stuff that was way ahead of the curve. The reason I bring it up is because one of the things that, you know, you've always been able to make available for the things you play with is web pages, or things go up on the web very fast. You knew how to do those things early on. I remember of all the musicians I've met here, there's very few that have that level of ease with
that. And I'm not really sure how that happened. I've always been like a little bit of a techie, although I was late to the game in getting a computer. Like when I was an undergrad, everybody else had, you know, they were selling these Apple IIe's on campus and everyone was buying them. Uh-huh. And I had like this Commodore 64 that got stolen, and then I had nothing. I just used what was in the labs.
Wow.
But once I dove in, I sort of tried to figure it out. And I got lucky in that I had friends that were good at that stuff. And so I would just, you know, John Worthington's been my personal help desk for getting close to 10 or 12 years now.
Who's John Worthington?
John is a friend of mine, produced the first Albert Ankrum Project record and produced my first Jeff Albert Quartet record. Mm-hmm. We just became friends. I'm not exactly sure how. Oh, I did he was recording some horn tracks for something Cranston Clements was putting together for the Casino. And me and Larry Ankrum and Barney Floyd were the horn section, and it was at John's house. Mm-hmm. John knew Cranston. Larry got me on the gig. And so I met John through that. And it's when we were doing the Albert Ankrum Project thing. So he started hanging out. So when it's time to make the record, he offered to help us do it. But he's a total computer whiz. So whenever I'd have a question, I'd just call John.
Mm-hmm. And how'd you meet John? From that?
From that session. And then he would start hanging out at gigs.
Because he was interested in music and all that. How did you decide that you were going to tackle this problem of expressing yourself, or what you felt like it was going to be?
After I finished at Loyola, I went out and worked for Carnival Cruise Lines for about 4 years.
Oh, really?
About three of those, I was band leader, musician, supervisor. You know, it was a nice life. A couple of things happened out there that made me realize I needed to leave. One of which was where I was hanging out with this trumpet player listening to music one night, and I pulled out this tape. We were talking about Monk tunes. And I said, oh, man, if you do I Mean You, like with a street beat on the intro, it's totally slamming. So I put on this tape of this demo that I had made that was me and Charlie Wooten on bass. Charlie just recently moved back to town. And Peter Cho on piano and Stanton Moore. Mm-hmm. And we did this in, like, I don't know, 1992, 93. And we played I Mean You, and Stanton just out of the blue laid this greasy ass street beat on the intro. Like, oh, that's great. Anyway, so I played it for my friend Dave on the ship. And we start talking, and it gets into the trombone solo, and Dave says, oh, man, who's this trombone player? I said, well, it's me. He says, really? You don't play like that anymore. I was like, ooh, wow. Mm-hmm. Right around that same time, there was a piano player named Amy, who I had dated for some time, and we broke up. But I was still the band leader, and she was still the piano player. And things were fine on the gig. She was very professional. It was cool. I went through a little heartbreak thing, got stood up by this purser. So one night I called the entire trombone set. Everything had a trombone solo. Or the entire dance set. Every song had a trombone solo. It was, you know, the regular bossa swing tune, whatever, but they were all trombone solo. And I just vented. Not in a George Lewis kind of venting, but I was, you know, getting it up. We get to the end of the set, and Amy leans over to me, and she says, "You can't do that." I was like, "Screw you. It's my band. I can call whatever I want." She said, "No, that's not what I'm talking about." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "You can't come play like that tonight and then come back and play that same candy-ass shit you've been playing tomorrow." And I wanted to be really upset. And it hit me, and I was like, "Oh my God, she's right."
That was a kind of compliment or something.
Yeah, and so that's when I realized I needed to leave. So I left, and I came back to New Orleans and thought, I should study with someone. I need to get better. And that led to me going to UNO and working on a master's degree, studying with Peterson and Mazakowski and those guys. Uh-huh. And that was sort of when I started making a conscious decision to, okay, I'm going to pursue creative artistic outlets.
So this is, you went back in as a master's program at UNO.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like 98, 99 was when I was there. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, I got married. Mm-hmm. And then I could afford to pursue creative things.
Okay.
Which was nice.
Mm. Sounds fortuitous. What, so what tools were you given at UNO that enabled you to do more of what you,
That's interesting. I really liked Steve Mazakowski's jazz harmony and theory class. I think by and large it's one of the most useful classes I've taken.
What is
it? Because I mean it's essentially like a, you know, harmony for non-rhythm section players class. Because I've always been a crappy piano player. And so I just sort of like was scared of that and didn't deal with it. But I have, like, my harmonic understanding is much greater after that class. And then I took some jazz composition lessons from Ed Peterson that were fabulous. Ed really helped me find some ways to get to my creative spots that I had, like, hadn't really realized how to do and how to work around some of my deficiencies. You know, for the first lesson, he said, "Well, bring some tunes." So I brought in some tunes, and he says, "All right, sit down at the piano and play them." And I sat down, and I'm, like, clumping through these things. And he says, "Do you write at the piano?" I said, "Yeah, a lot of times." He says, "Well, that's your problem. You're a crappy piano player. Mm-hmm. And you're sitting down at the piano trying to write good music, but you can't play the piano." Mm-hmm. So we found other ways to get to the music, mm-hmm. which is very useful. I mean, still, when I sit down to write, things that I learned from Ed in that setting come mm-hmm. through.
What, it's interesting because Ed's from Chicago, of course. What, here's the thing. Many ago you explained about, you know, that you wanted to put the trombone solos and you wanted to play this way, and this was very expressive, and I suspect this at least was a pointer for you in the direction of what you were saying, that you needed to do something that was more you. And then you get to UNO, and Ed's pointing out these things. Steve gives you some tools that you were talking about, and Ed points out these particular features about writing. Did you have an urge to write music? You wanted to write songs?
Yeah, I did. Well, there's this thing that, you know, like every creative artist, every jazz dude writes. They all write tunes, or at least all the ones that I liked and respected, and I shouldn't say most. Uh-huh. And so I would sit down and try to write tunes, and I was crappy at it. Mm. And I was like, you know, nobody wants to hear me play Stella by Starlight. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I'm going to have something to offer, like, I need to write the vehicles too. Mm-hmm. Which ultimately led to me realizing that, you know, I'm not a bebop trombone player. Mm-hmm. And the sort of mainstream jazz thing I can do, but it's not really, I think, where my gifts lie. And that all ultimately helped me find a place now where the music that I make with my band, I feel very comfortable with. And I